It's believed that 1% of the population is a psychopath, but the vast majority of these individuals, they won't be violent during their lifetime. A minority, however, will use their antisocial personality disorder to fulfill horrific, warped fantasies. Fantasies that are often formed in childhood and played out in their minds thousands and thousands of times. This is a story of one such individual. This is a disturbing case of Kevin Davis. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Today's case, woo! It's gonna be one of those that, particularly for our mums out there, kind of makes you go, wow. We bring up our kids, we adore them. They are the most important people in our universes. And the idea that our child could be harboring sinister thoughts about us, that their malevolent nature is bubbling beneath the surface, unknown to us, and their disastrous, disturbing thoughts are festering in a way that one day is going to bubble over and affect us, is something that so few of us would ever even want to consider, let alone live through. But in March 2014, emergency services receive a call. This call's from an 18-year-old Kevin Jazrael Davis. He wasn't actually calling on his own mobile. He wasn't even on his home phone. In fact, he was using the phone of a couple in Robstown, Texas. Now, this is relatively nearby his home. He lived in Corpus Christi, but he isn't actually at his home address. Now, Davis had basically gone up to their front door, knocked on that door, and then just calmly explained, and I mean calmly explained, that he'd murdered somebody, and then asked if he could call the police. I think this demonstrates the genuine kindness and also, at times, the over-trusting nature of particular individuals. Because I don't know about you, but if somebody knocked on my door and was like, can I just borrow your phone? I've just murdered somebody. I'd be like, I'm just gonna gently close the door and then I'll make the call for you. Because the idea of lending somebody a phone who's just admitted that they killed somebody is something that's a little bit of a stretch too far for me. I'd happily offend the person calling themselves a murderer and not risk my own life. But nonetheless, they're probably just thinking to themselves, this is just a kid. He's probably just making something up. Maybe he's having some kind of mental breakdown. It's highly unlikely that he's actually murdered somebody. And they allow him to make a call. So the couple, they dial 911 and then dutifully, they hand him the telephone. Now the officers who are called that night and go and pick Davis up, they obviously bring him in for questioning. You can imagine at this moment in time, they deal with kids all the time, dealing with fantasies. They obviously also deal with murder, but there must have been a moment during picking him up, thinking to themselves, are we just in a situation where we're dealing with some kind of fantasist? Is this just a kid who wants some kind of notoriety and wants to be brought in? And I guess that's the hope. Because it's a far nicer idea that what you're dealing with is a kid who's fantasizing than actually dealing with a cold-blooded killer. Unfortunately, in this case, that's literally exactly who they've picked up. Now, what is striking, and you'll see a lot of this during this particular video, is he is so calm. I mean, throughout his interactions with the police, he's cooperative. He constantly is able to give people details. So, for example, he's able to tell them exactly what he's done that night and to describe in detail exactly what he's done to an innocent, unsuspecting victim. And bear in mind, these are seasoned officers. They've heard some of the most horrific details in their career. But even for those most seasoned veterans, the content of what he disclosed literally shook them to the core. Because we have this unassuming, softly spoken teenager, certainly doesn't look like the kind of individual that you would imagine to be a killer. And he's just talking about what he'd subjected his victim to, these unspeakable acts. But if it's not horrific and traumatizing and despicable to have to listen to this core information about this horrific killing, what makes it even more sinister, even more shocking, is that the victim was his own mother, 50-year-old Kimberly Diane Hill. He's murdered his own mother. Now, prior to the interview, officers had actually attended Davis's home because the obvious confession on the 911 call had led them to do that. And like I said, part of piecing together this puzzle is figuring out whether this kid's actually telling the truth. Is there going to be somebody dead at the apartment, or is this kid just making it up? But wow, he really wasn't making it up. When the police entered the apartment, the scene that they were met with was beyond grisly. I am talking horror movie level. And you know, when you see those horror movies, you can't even in your head imagine that they don't play out in reality. It's all for the viewer. It's meant to be amplified. We're talking in this situation, that's exactly what you're seeing. It's like somebody has created this horror movie set. It's like a slaughterhouse. And I don't use that word lightly, because that is so evocative of this kind of horror that to use that word inappropriately wouldn't be fair, but it's true. There's trails of blood all over the apartment, and those trails are leading from the front room, they're into Kimberly's bedroom, and they can kind of tell just from initially looking that it seems to be that Kimberly's been attacked in her front room, and then she's been dragged to her bedroom. And they can tell just by using their eyes that she has endured the most horrific physical assault. It's just beyond traumatic, the injuries that have occurred to her. So she's suffered from intensely severe head trauma. And the officers just seeing the scene can literally look at her and see her brain matter that's actually viewed through her shattered skull. So they can see it visibly at that point. They see a hammer that's just covered in blood that's found at the scene, and the assumption is that's obviously been used. But on top of this absolutely horrible scene that's playing out in front of their eyes, there is something else that is really, really striking. It's the fact that her body's been posed. She's naked from the waist down. So instantly they're being drawn to this sexual element around it. They also find a really bloodied knife nearby. And then really oddly, officers also find three handwritten notes in the house. So one of those notes is in the living room, and it's addressed to Davis's sister. She's called Desiree. And it says, "Keep your head, hurry. She might still be alive, although I highly doubt it." Second note's in Kimberly's bedroom, "Chase me. Sorry for the mess, KD." On a third note in Davis's bedroom, well, that details his murder and escape plan. But just from the notes that I've told you about there, what are you hearing? You're hearing a level of humour. This isn't somebody panicking. This is somebody taking the time to express the way that they're feeling, either during or after this murder. They're letting you know that they're in control, but they're also finding what's played out not terrifying, not horrifying, not regretful, not remorseful. You're seeing somebody who's enjoying the moment. And when we see murderers who enjoy the moment, we know that we are dealing with the most malevolent souls that you can ever, ever fear coming across in your world. Now, later at the station, when Davis has actually been taken there, he sits down, and again, all you see is this very odd calmness. Because if you think about the fact you've just murdered your mother, and you've got some reflection experience, suddenly it's sinking in, you're in a police station, you're realizing that your life has changed forever. There's gonna be some kind of emotional experience, surely, but no, not where Davis is concerned. He's really in control. And he starts to very eloquently explain to detectives how the events happened to unfold that day on the 27th of March, 2014. So he said, "Okay, I felt bored. I felt frustrated in my life for a long time." I mean, he's 18. Welcome to the world of being 18. You ain't got a lot of money. You ain't got a lot of options. Often in the areas that you live, there's not loads going on. Boredom is part of being young. Actually, it's pretty good for imagination and creating and cultivating dreams. But of course, if you haven't got the emotional cogency and capacity to actually do things like have those visualized hopes and dreams, then chances are that you are going to be someone who gets bored. And let's be honest, when you think about antisocial personality disorder, psychopathy, these issues mean that you don't feel, shall we say, excited very often. Obviously, you don't feel fear very often, and you don't feel guilt or remorse, but also you don't feel that excited. And we like to feel occasionally excited in life. And if there is a problem with that, and that can extenuate our boredom, then obviously that can cause frustration. And Davis is expressing that this is what he is feeling on the 27th of March, 2014. And he also talks about the fact from a very early age, particularly as a younger child onwards, he had thoughts of suicide. So he's thinking about self-destruction, he's thinking about escape, he's thinking about, I suppose one could argue, rebelling against the world that he's in. There are lots of different facets and belief systems around suicide, and I appreciate that when I talk about suicide, it can be triggering for people. I also appreciate that everyone has got very different thoughts on it, and I appreciate that some people don't believe that rebellion is the correct word to use. Being a daughter of suicide with respect and having researched the area extensively for my own grief process, I do believe that rebellion plays a part in certain suicide attempts and certain suicides that are successful, because I think it's a rejection of the life that somebody can at times feel forced to live in. And obviously what we always want with people who are suicidal and deal with ideation is to realize that of course they're deserving to live, of course they are worthy, and of course the things that make life very, very difficult and traumatic at times that feel like they're everlasting can change, and hope is possible. And that's what we want to give to people who have those feelings. But nonetheless, again, when you're an individual who maybe doesn't have the emotional capacity and you can't really think about the nuances that could essentially help you to gravitate to more positive areas because of your actual mindset within an antisocial personality, then potentially this could be something that feels alluring, having absolute control over being alive or not being alive. He said that he really didn't like people. He really didn't like life. Now, what's interesting in that statement is he isn't actually talking about him being unhappy in his life. So he's not saying, hey, I have a horrible experience in existence. It's more, I don't like the world and I don't like the people in it. Therefore, I'm potentially electing to leave. But there is a level of arrogance there. It's a sense of you are all not worthy of me, as opposed to me thinking I am not worthy of life. So that is an interesting way, perception-wise, of seeing the world. And again, quite distinct from what we see with people who struggle genuinely with suicidal ideation and behaviours that unfortunately at times lead to people losing their lives.
Start at the beginning, man. What caused all this?
Well, the very beginning, I asked my mother for permission to die, or rather kind of commit suicide, the sort of beating around the bush sort of thing. Because, well, that doesn't really matter why I wanted to kill myself.
Sure it does. It does.
I'm bored with life. I don't like life. I don't like people. I don't like living it, basically. There's really nothing, anything depressing about it. It just is what it is.
Now, it's that evening, on that day, when he's particularly ruminating about the fact that he feels bored about his life, that he gets to about 8:30 p.m. Now, he's at home at this moment in time, as he would have been hundreds of times before. He's with his mother, Kimberly, in Windrush Apartments, number 1707, Corpus Christi, Texas. This is where he lives. He is with his mother. She knows her son. And whilst I'm sure that she believed there were certain quirks about him, certainly their life together would never have prepared her, not even for a blink of an eye, that what was going to play out that evening was going to play out. She would have been completely unaware of what was going on in her son's mind. Now, his sister, this is 24-year-old Desiree Danielle Hill. She actually lived nearby, close relationship with the family, so she'd often call round. She was actually at work at this time, and Davis's biological father, he wasn't actually involved in his life. And Davis went ahead and said that he actually considered his father to be an idiot when he was discussing him with the police. Kimberly, however, as opposed to the idiot father that he believed he had, she was an absolutely 100% devoted mother. She worked as a hospice caregiver, so that in itself shows you the kind of level of compassion that she works within. She literally has a vocation that is working with people at their most vulnerable. So she's somebody who's absolutely compassionate beyond belief. And the people who knew her said she was really loving, she was really caring. And the words are used by people who knew her to describe her job and how she was within it. And they said she meticulously doted on those who were dying. Again, the gift that somebody gives when they really see people in their most vulnerable states and help to cradle them into death, I think that says something really quite beautiful and profound about this woman. And earlier in her life, so before she did this, this is between 1982 and 1992, she'd also served her country. She served as a Marine corporal. So what are we seeing? Kimberly is this pro-social, loving, giving woman. And as I said, a woman who's fully devoted herself to being a mother. The hallmarks of a secure foundation. Okay, we have the fact that father isn't in the picture. We have the fact there is a level of dysfunction there, but it is so normalized in our culture now that lots of people will know other people with families that have broken up. My own family broke up when my little boys were 2 and 4. Of course, that is a level of dysfunction, but as long as a mother creates those foundations of security and feeds their children, loves their children, gives them the activities that they desire, makes them feel safe, your kids are gonna be fine. It's as simple as that. It might not be as ideal as having two parents at home, because we'd all love to have that perfect picture of possibility for the future with our children, but it's not as realistic as it probably was in the 1920s. Although, to be fair, you couldn't really leave back then. It was socially not acceptable. But you know what I'm saying? This is a woman who's literally created the perfect environment for her children, and Desiree is an amazing woman. So she has a blueprint that says she's been successful. Also, she was really somebody who enjoyed socializing. She loved concerts, gardening. She loved skydiving. So she's somebody who really embraces life. And again, that just adds more emphasis to how out of the blue what I'm going to talk about this particular crime is, and how strikingly unprepared anybody would have been who knew Davis, who knew his family, to actually find out what he was capable of. Because that's one of the things, when you actually live in an environment where there is a killer in your neighborhood, somebody that you've seen, somebody you've gone to school with, somebody you were friends with, somebody that you spoke to at the local shops, neighbours, etc., who know you. When you carry out a crime, incomprehensible, out of the blue, sadistic, it changes the way that people perceive others, because you think, well, I didn't see his potential. And if I didn't see his potential, what does that mean about other people who live around me? And so many people feel that when your life changes because an individual that you thought loved you harms you, or when you're walking home one night, something occurs that you never believed would occur in your area, it shifts and changes the way that you feel about your world. So Davis is going to have a ripple effect on anybody who's met him, because this crime has such gravity, it's so unusual, that it causes people to question whether they can trust anybody, because their instincts didn't direct them to understand that this person had such potential. Now, the night that this crime plays out, interaction occurs with Davis and his mother. So he tells his mum that he wants to end his life. Now, Kimberly is going to be really upset by this. If your child tells you they don't want to be here, and I can personally relate to this, I really can, after my father's suicide, my youngest son, and I've talked openly about this, and he understands that. The reason I talk openly about this is because I think it's really integral and important to have conversations that are really difficult about suicide. And because no one tells you when somebody kills themselves that you absolutely live for and love, that you're gonna wanna not be here anymore. And that's really powerfully important, because when somebody says, hey, it's completely normal to question your mortality and you're not gonna wanna be here because the pain's horrible, you go, oh, right, okay, so this is normal. And then maybe if that's normal, I will get through it. Whereas when people don't tell you that, you think there's something going wrong with you. You think there's something deeply broken, and it causes you to think that you might actually want to go ahead and do those things. And certainly, I've talked openly with my children, and my youngest son certainly expressed that he didn't necessarily want to be here. And it's incredibly painful for a mother, because firstly, you know, well, that would be a game over if something happened to my child. But the other thing is, how do I reach you in that pain? How do I cradle the agony? How do I support you so that you truly believe that in time there will be a worth to living again? How do I remind you that laughter will come, and that smiles will be, and that love will be something you encounter with girls that you meet and a future that you create? But in that moment, you just want time to stop, and you just want to be able to prevent anything else hurting your child. So I totally understand that for Kimberly, it would be absolutely devastating to hear her son say that. But what she actually says to him is something I also understand. And the reason I understand it is because, most likely due to my actual training therapeutically and in the psychological areas, because when people express a desire to harm themselves or to take their own life, you can't bolt from that. You can't reject what they're saying. You certainly can't shame them and suggest that what they're thinking and doing is incorrect. Your job is to hold the space, and also to not reject the statement, which feels quite difficult, because the human reaction is, don't be ridiculous, you don't want to do that, everybody cares for you, and so on and so forth. Those kind of platitudes that we've been brought up with, they're not helpful. So essentially, what Kimberly does is what we often do in therapy. We'll often say, for example, okay, well, obviously you've considered a strategy, and I'm not going to take that away from you, but maybe we can explore some other less permanent strategies. So you're not removing the fact that this person has considered some kind of strategy. You're just suggesting maybe there are some more. And obviously, on a safeguarding level, you want to make sure that you do that effectively to understand whether this is something you need to take further to protect them and to protect their lives. So what Kimberly actually does is she says, well, you're a man now. That means I can't stop you. If that's what you want to do, I'm not going to be able to stop you. Now, on one level, people will think, ooh, it's a little bit cold. Your child's saying they don't want to be here, and your response is, okay, well, I actually can't stop you. But if you've heard it time and time before, and bear in mind, he's wanted to take his life, apparently, according to him, on several occasions, if not more. So the consequences could be that she's tried everything, and she's thinking to herself, okay, I'm not going to do the please don't. I'm not going to do the what else could you think of. What I'm going to do this time is just peacefully acknowledge I can't stop you. To maybe give him responsibility for his own feelings, and to remind him that even though she would wish to change his behaviour and decisions, she knows that she's powerless to do so to some degree. But he doesn't interpret it that way. And it is a risky scenario to put on another person to actually use that language. But like I said, I have total empathy and sympathy with her because of her past experiences. She's probably running out of patience. She's probably feeling that he's using it to emotionally manipulate her. And the consequence of that is she's not willing to put up with it anymore as well. So she's trying this different tack. Now, David said that did something. That sparked an anger. It really did. He was angry with the way that she responded. Why? Because he didn't get to manipulate her in the way that he wanted to. So they end up arguing, and Kimberly had actually called her daughter and said, look, can you come and pick your brother up after work? Just get him away for a bit. And I think, again, what does that show with Kimberly? Great restraint, understanding that he needs to cool off, creating an opportunity so that can occur. Again, props to Kimberly for doing that. She thinks about a way of making him feel held, i.e. his sister's going to come, whilst also giving them space that needs to occur for them to cool down in that situation. Now, he said he actually mulled all this over in his mind for a while. And at that point, he decides that he's going to change tack, he's going to change his plan. And the way he's going to shift his plan is he's not going to take his own life, but instead he's going to take his mother's life and his sister's life. Now, again, just bringing in the whole perspective of somebody with a suicidal mindset, that's not how you shift your thoughts. Somebody who is truly suicidal, they are dealing with some of the most overwhelmingly challenging feelings that make them feel like they are suffocating and drowning. And it is desperate. It's not, I feel suicidal, but I'm going to mull it over in my mind. Oh, now I'm going to actually change tack and I'm going to murder my sister and my mother. I'm not buying that at all. I think what he's talking about is a desire to destruct something, to destroy. And he's in a scenario where the argument has created, as far as he is concerned, the perfect excuse to go ahead and do that. Now, he knows his sister's going to be arriving after work to pick him up because obviously he's heard that plan happening. And because he'd heard his mother make the call, he recognises that he's got a time frame. So basically, it's at this point he writes down his plan to kill his family and then to escape on the Greyhound bus. Again, why is he writing it down? Well, because the thing about, shall we say, a budding serial killer is, like many of our serial killers, they really don't like their crimes to be silent. They like witnesses to their work. And writing these things down, first of all, it makes it real to him. Secondly, it plays into his fantasy. And most importantly, it means that he leaves essentially a map of the reality of what he's done. It's a signature, isn't it? I did this.
What got you to this point? Tell us about what got you to this point. Did you hate life? You wanted to commit suicide? Oh, what did you say about when you told her you wanted in a roundabout way to commit suicide? She said no. She said yes. What did she say to you?
She said, basically, I'm a grown man, and what I do, she can't really stop me. She was distraught over it, of course. I mean,
of course.
Yeah, she said she'd cope with it. I mean, if you kill him, that's kind of why she wanted me to go away, why she called my sister to come pick me up, and that's kind of why I just left.
At that point, you got pissed?
Not necessarily. I just knew it was time to act now or never.
Now, I would absolutely argue that from what I've said already, you'll be aware that this particular mindset of murder hadn't just arrived that evening. This wasn't just a spur of the moment decision for Davis. And during the interview, he just voluntarily admits that this is something he's been fantasizing about literally for years. He'd been considering in his head murdering his mother and his sister as far back as he can remember, essentially. Claims he was a pervert and said that the signs were always there, but his family had actually overlooked them.
You ever tell anybody else what your plans were? That, you know, what you wanted to do to your mom or your sister?
No, but over the years, there were hints. As a younger boy, I was a lot dumber, a lot more angsty, you know. I said things, but I guess they basically brushed it off. I guess the hints were everywhere, but they're my family. Family looks past that kind of stuff, or they try to not look at it,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
And I think that insight is really intriguing, because I do believe that for the most part, the vast majority of us parents, even if our child is exhibiting worrying and concerning behaviours, we tend to buy into a belief that it's just a phase that they're going through. But sometimes we do that to our own detriment, without a doubt. Think about Ted Bundy, 3 years old, really obsessed with knives. Auntie wakes up with knives all around her. Think about Ed Kemper, fixated on a particular teacher. When asked whether he would kiss her, he said he would, but he'd have to kill her first. So we see that these kind of odd and violent connections, they seem to reside within the bodies and minds of these killers really early on. And he said that he just had violent fantasies for absolute years about hurting people. And one of the detectives actually says, do you want to kill us? And Davis says, no, it's only ever directed towards women. Again, really concerning and disconcerting, because the only people who'd actually loved him and stayed with him in his life were women, his sister, his mother. They'd been consistent themes. They hadn't abandoned him. They hadn't left him. They loved him. And yet they are considered by him to be worthy of the rage that he feels inside. He said, until the moment that he went ahead and murdered his mother, all of those violent, dark fantasies, he'd been able to control them. These violent predilections had been something that he'd managed to calm to a degree. But when his mother responded about her not having the power to change his mind regarding the suicide, he said, that was it. That was the trigger. Now, on the face of it, some of you actually might feel that Kimberly's reaction to her son wishing to end his life could have been a little bit unsympathetic. But again, I just want to reinforce, as far as I am concerned, I suspect that there's probably lots of similar conversations, because the one thing that I will note at this point, although I'm sure you have already garnered this reality for yourselves, is that Davis is a natural-born psychopath. Natural-born psychopath. And that means by nature, he's very manipulative. He's got a mindset of controlling other people. They like to be in charge of the world around them. And his mother's response just failed to follow the script. And if you fail to follow the script, that's going to make me angry. So he snaps. It's that tiny failure that enables him to escalate the violence that he's been bubbling over inside for so long. So Davis explains this. He said, when he puts the plan into action, basically his mother Kimberly is just sat on the couch, as she would be doing, just watching TV, utterly unaware of what is about to unfold. Davis, he goes and gets a power lead from his games console, and he goes up, creeps behind her, and she's just sitting there, watching a TV show. And the next minute she feels the cord go around her neck, and he's starting to try to strangle her. But like I always say, human beings are unpredictable, and you can fantasize about how something is going to play out in your head. But when it actually comes to commissioning the crime and going ahead and doing it, it changes, because people react in ways that we never thought that they would. If you put something around somebody's neck and start choking them, the truth is there's going to be a reaction, and that reaction is going to be to fight back. And so it doesn't go. Even though he'd played this over hundreds of times in his head, how he played that out in his head. Because she immediately manages to get her fingers under the lead, and that allows her to scream, and she starts screaming because she can't believe this. Her son, her only son, is literally trying to murder her on her couch in her own front room, and she's done absolutely nothing to provoke this. So Davis, now he's fighting with his mother and she's screaming. He gives up trying to garrote her. And she's clearly in shock. She's panicking now. What the hell's happening? Why is her son doing this? And suddenly he leaves her and he runs to the bedroom. Now I imagine in that moment, Kimberly is trying to regain her thoughts and figure out what's happening and hoping that he's just snapped for a moment and it's over, but it's not over. It's absolutely not over. He runs back to the bedroom. He retrieves a hammer from her bottom drawer. And then he just returns and he proceeds to batter her again and again around the head with it. During the attack, she's obviously trying to defend herself. So she gets injuries to her hands where he strikes her with the hammer when she's trying to protect her head. Now, according to Davis, she was out pretty quick. So we have to imagine the force of being hit by a hammer is going to be incredibly powerful and incredibly devastating to our brain. But in those seconds where she's fighting, she was fully conscious of what was playing out. Like I said, there were defensive wounds to her hands. But even though he says that she was out pretty quickly, that doesn't stop him. This is not going to be a scenario where, oh, I've done it, I've killed her. No, because that was never just the intention, was it? This isn't an individual with years of pent-up rage who just snaps and in a crime of passion kills his mother because he's so angry. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about somebody who's had dark fantasies for so long, and now it's his perfect opportunity, the prime time, so he can live out all of those sick ideas that he's been harboring for so long. He carries on striking her head at least 20 times with the hammer. He splits the skull wide open, and he said at this point she's snoring like a baby. Now, you and I both know when somebody is snoring like a baby after they're having serious head injuries, that's not snoring. It's dying. It's as simple as that. But this is the way that he's actually suggesting things are playing out. So even the fact that he's saying snoring like a baby, minimizing. Oh, she's out. She's asleep. What I do now really doesn't matter because she's out cold. Bear in mind, the detectives are having to listen to this. This kid, he's 18, and he's so adept at describing exactly what played out. And they know this is his mother. And even though what I've just told you is harrowing enough, and those detectives must have been sat really open-mouthed, even though they wouldn't have demonstrated it, the truth is Davies is only just getting started. So then he goes on to explain why he wanted his mother dead. He said, it wasn't just because I wanted to kill her. I didn't just want to end her life. I actually had these plans for her body. Because we all know, serial killers, whether it's their first kill or their last kill, they've been living in fantasy for a very long time. They've been building up to this moment. And for such a long time, they've been able to use the fantasy to prevent the movement into that behaviour. But that tipping point has occurred. And now he's fully engaged in living out and playing out that fantasy. And the body is what he really, really wants. So Davies explains that after he'd decimated her head with the hammer, he then feels that he wants to make sure he's finished his mother off. So he takes a kitchen knife and he inserts that kitchen knife into a gaping hole in the back of her skull. And then he swirls and stirs her brain around with the blade. I mean, just describing that makes me feel quite nauseous. And the idea of actually going ahead and doing something like that to another human being is so incomprehensible because there is such an aversion to doing any harm, but let alone that kind of grisly, gruesome physical experience with another person. It's really distressing to imagine, let alone to think that somebody quite happily, and I use the word happily for a reason because that's what he did it. He did it with glee. It's the stuff of horror movies. It's the stuff of nightmares. Now, when this, as far as he is concerned, doesn't actually prove an effective way of actually finishing her off, he takes the knife out of her skull and then he uses his own hands. Literally, he places his hand into her skull and he swirls her brain some more. And he even described it to the detective. He said it felt like putty. This is his mother's brain. And he's so able to just disassociate himself from the actual reality of what he's doing to a point where it's almost sarcasm to some degree. His descriptive use of the word putty, it's talking about a woman that he's executed who brought him up. And yet he's totally at peace with that.
I tried to strangle her with a cord. Mm-hmm. A ripped cord from a video game console controller. That didn't work, huh?
What was this that you thought of strangling?
She was sitting on the couch watching TV.
Okay.
That didn't work out too well. She started screaming, and so I went to her room, mm-hmm. opened a drawer at the very bottom to the right. I pulled out a hammer, I went back in the living room, and well, you kind of get the gist from there. And, she was out pretty quickly, kind of tried to play dead at first, but then I finished it.
So you hit her with a hammer when she was sitting in the sofa in the living room?
No, first I tried to strangle her, and uh-huh. that didn't work, right. So I grabbed the cord, so I raced back into her room,
mm-hmm.
grabbed the hammer, came back out, and then did it.
Okay. How many times
did you hit with a hammer in the living room?
At least 20, but then she was still alive. I dragged her into the room, as you probably clearly saw, and then I picked, kind of warmed my hands into her brain to kind of just cut it. Mm-hmm. She was still snoring.
Okay, so she was still alive?
She was still alive.
And you went in there and you kind of grabbed those brains?
Yeah, finished it.
It's obvious that Davies wanted to kill his mother from the outset, but the manner in which he actually carried out that killing is completely gratuitous. And it's evident from what he's saying that he got immense satisfaction from the experience, like living out this dark fantasy. And this dark fantasy hasn't finished there. It's going to get even darker, guys. So then Davis drags his mum's body from the living room to the bedroom. That's why all those blood marks were seen by the investigators when they arrived at the apartment. That trail of blood that's left in the process. Now, on account of Kimberly's horrific, horrific head wounds, he described doing that as very sloppy. Again, we're talking about somebody using object language, aren't we? It's not describing a human who's been decimated. It's not describing a loving mother. It's describing a body that was very sloppy. So his descriptor is not about the person. It's about the result of the body actually leaving a particular mess because of what he's done to her. Also, this guy says he's not very strong, so it was quite actually difficult to drag her. So he ends up pulling her by her clothing. But he knows what he's doing, doesn't he? Why doesn't he just leave her in situ? He's killed her. He's succeeded in doing that. Leave her there. But like I said, we're not halfway to what this intention is. This isn't about just murdering her. If only it had been. I mean, that's tragic and terrible enough, but it would at least not make us have to consider the type of human beings and predators that exist within our world, as we will do when we further explore what he does.
I actually had to drag her by her clothes to get her in there. It was very laborious, actually.
Mm-hmm. She's a pretty big woman, she's heavy.
Yeah.
Explain to her how you grabbed her so that you wouldn't leave such a mess in the carpet.
That...
Did you carry her from underneath the arms and just dragged her, or how did you drag her?
It was very sloppy, actually. Yeah. I kind of just winged it. I dragged her from her shirt. I dragged her by her legs. I dragged her by any way I kind of felt. I mean,
okay.
I don't really exert physical labor too, mm-hmm. So I'm not a very strong person.
She's bigger than you are.
Yeah.
She's a little bigger than you.
So he gets her into her bedroom. And then he undresses his own mother's body, and then he rapes her. He rapes his mother's battered corpse. And he's even able to confirm to the detectives that he ejaculated inside her. Our detectives, understandably, at this point, want to know whether it's something that he's done before. And Davis said that this was actually the first time that he'd done it. And he stated, oh yeah, I lost my virginity to a corpse. Genuinely, this is an 18-year-old we're talking about. And again, what are we seeing regarding the emotional disconnection? Oh yeah, I lost my virginity to his corpse. It's your mother.
And then what did you do after that?
Then I had sex with her corpse.
You did? Okay. Did you come inside her?
I did, actually.
Have you ever done that before, like had sex with her?
No, I haven't, actually.
This is just the first time?
Oh yeah, I lost my virginity to a corpse.
Okay.
You've literally had sex with your mother's dead body after you have brutally slain her. Now, again, what is contextual with Davis, with respect, is that he fully connects with what our understanding of violent psychopaths are. So he's more than willing, if not happy, to describe and explain the mindset that he had to his detectives. He even stated that he was interested in artistic ways of murder, the way they slice the pieces with such love. I mean, if ever there's a juxtaposition, the juxtaposition would be slicing pieces of a body with love. There is nothing loving about murder. There is nothing artistic about death in the way that we're talking about today. This is somebody who is so absolutely skewed mentally that he can find beauty in violence and absolute artistic expression in the decimation and desecration and humiliation of a corpse. So this is probably the most dangerous type of mindset that we can ever talk about. Now, at multiple points during that particular interview, he goes on to admit that he's had loads and loads of fantasies about having sex with a woman's corpse, and that he actually fantasized a great deal as he was growing up about having sex with his mother and sister's corpse. So they're the two women he has most access to. They're the two women that he sees more of the time. Therefore, his fantasy becomes fixated around them because he has more access to them. The titillation he feels within the fantasy is, well, they're present, this could happen. And that's likely why he fantasizes most about them.
Well, despite how I ended her life, I'm kind of more fascinated by the more artistic ways of murder, the meticulous manner, the way they cut them open, just slice them to pieces with, I mean, such care, such love. And
so when David is pressed again on whether he'd actually carried out this type of behaviour before, he said, well, actually, yeah, once when I was younger, I had sex with a corpse. And he also explained at this point that he was into bestiality. He said that he'd strangled and drowned the family cat, carved it open and used its wound to gratify himself. WTF. He's 18. I mean, we are talking about absolutely the hallmarks of a serial killer, aren't we? Absolutely. I mean, he's got necrophiliac tendencies and he's actually acted on them. He's had these fantasies from a young age, but then he's done things to gratify himself. And at this point, he even says, you know, I'm somebody who doesn't have any morals. I'm somebody who doesn't have any standards. I just see bodies as pieces of meat. We see that a lot, don't we, with serial killers. Think about Jeffrey Dahmer, the Milwaukee cannibal. I mean, he talks about the fact that you can just dehumanize people and it makes you find it easier to do terrible things to them. Very similarly, this is the type of language that David is using.
You mentioned that you lost your virginity to a corpse.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? What happened?
Oh, well, just last night, my mother, yeah.
Okay, not somebody else. You're talking about your mom.
Yes.
Okay, so before that, you had never had sex?
Well, I guess since I'm being quiet about it, I might as well tell you now. Yeah, and it's on the note, too, the P.S. part. We used to have a gray cat named Claire. Oh, yeah, bestiality is a thing of mine, too, now you know. And so I strangled it, I drowned it, and then I cut it open, and you know the rest. Mm. Kind of get the rest.
You had sex with the cat, with the dead cat?
Cool. Yeah, ripped it open, stuck it in there, yeah.
You ever had sex with a live person?
No. No.
So that your thing, having sex with a live person, that doesn't turn you on. It's dead thing, dead person, dead animals. That's what turns you on.
I don't necessarily mind. I don't have standards or morals. Mm-hmm. Body's a body, and in the end, it's a piece of meat. I guess it's harsh to say, but.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I don't necessarily mind.
Now, at one point, a detective actually says to him, what would be your ultimate fantasy? And I don't really think that this is actually that important for the questioning because, you know, you have somebody who's banged to rights, you have somebody who's taken full responsibility for the killing, you've had somebody who's absolutely talked you through how it happened. Really, you don't need to know what their ultimate fantasy is going to be. But I kind of feel that the detectives would have been so blindsided by what they're listening to, they almost need to ask those questions for their own benefit to fully connect with the malevolence of the individual that they're actually talking to. I think it's probably really difficult for them to even comprehend that this is playing out in front of them. And the more that they can hear the warped mind, the more they can actually accept that this young man is the monster that he absolutely is making himself out to be. So without hesitation when he's asked this question, he just describes it in detail because it's there. He's got his number one fantasy ready. Bear in mind, hundreds, thousands of times he's gone through this, he's lived for this. This is what he's always wanted to do. And he explains this, he says, I prefer my women dead. So he said that what he'd do was he'd dress up in a really nice suit, then he'd break into a couple's house, then he would disable the man before butchering the woman. Interestingly, when you think about Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, it's very resonant of that, isn't it? That's exactly what he used to do. Home invasions, shoot the men, and then spend time brutally assaulting the woman, raping the woman, etc. So you do wonder whether there's some influence taken from those particular crimes. So he said, ideally, I would decapitate her, but then I'd sew her head back on So he'd absolutely destroy her, but then he'd place the head back on now that he had taken her life. And then he said that he'd dress her up in a nice dress and he'd have brought the dress with him. So he'd even have planned out exactly what she was going to look like. And then he'd have sex with her body. And he said to the detectives, it would be a night to remember.
I tell you what, give me your fancy of killing a woman. What would your fancy killing would be? Your ace killing, what could that be?
This is a little peculiar, I'm on camera. Okay,
I'm not surprised at what I'm going to hear, but you tell me.
Maybe dressing up in a nice suit, sneaking into her house, disabling her boyfriend. You know, yeah, I'd bring a pretty dress with me to dress her up in. I was always into strangling, but after that last blunder, I guess maybe something big and sharp would be more along my thing. Mm-hmm. And I could, I don't know, probably decapitate her, as I prefer my women dead. Okay. I'd dress her up, I'd stitch her up, kind of try to work the head back on, perhaps. And then I'd go to town, and it would be a night to remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd kind of just burn everything and run for the hills.
Now, Davis also confirmed that his original plan had actually been to kill his mother, but then to also wait for his sister Desiree, and then when she arrived, kill her too. And he said, actually, you know what? I would have also intended to have killed her and then raped her corpse. The detectives say, okay, well, what changed? Why did you not go through with that plan? And Davis then calmly explains to them, well, you know what? I just had my fill of killing. And he said to have killed his sister just seemed like it was a little bit too much. I mean, murder and rape your mother, that's okay, apparently. But do the same to your sister, that's a little much. Again, total disassociation from what we're actually talking about. I mean, he's murdered his own mother, this poor, compassionate, lovely woman that's brought him up. And he can just so coolly and calmly and coldly dismiss her and explain that, well, he could have killed his sister, but, you know, he kind of had his fill.
Was it a fantasy of yours to kill her as well?
It was.
Did you write down that on your note?
Oh, I did, actually, but I decided against it because, well, I'd had my fill of killing. I didn't seem a little much.
Mm-hmm.
A little too excessive, yeah.
Anyway, as we know, he left notes for her. He left notes for the police at the crime scene. So there's some kind of planning that's gone in there. And the detectives are really intrigued by this. So they say to him, did you do this to mess with your sister's head? Was it something that you wanted to traumatize her with? Obviously, she's going to walk into this horrific scene. Was that the intention? Now, Davis implied that the reason that he'd done it was because he knew that she was going to be really badly traumatized, badly affected by what she saw. So he reckoned that he'd left the notes as kind of a heads up, claims it was just his sense of humour, and he also said he was off his rocker at that stage, was in a, quote, playful mood when he wrote them. A playful mood. He's murdered his mother, he's raped his mother's corpse, and he's in a playful mood. But again, it just shows you how distinct his mindset is from yours or mine. And even though he says he was off his rocker at that stage, what he really means is he was highly excitable. We would expect that that's exactly where he'd be. He's probably in quite a euphoric stage at that moment in time. I feel that the detectives are right, by the way. I feel without a shadow of a doubt the reason that he left that note, the reason that it was so non-remorseful, it was playful, shall we say. It was so out of character for what we were actually dealing with. Genuinely think it was about traumatizing his sister. I think that he knew that the notes would cause maximum psychological impact. And the reason I feel that is because obviously if his sister had discovered the body, then she would definitely, even if she'd initially just seen blood, even if there had been a note present, it wouldn't have prevented her from going and looking, and she would have found a mother. And what would have been highly traumatizing, on top of the fact that she's seeing the brutalized, bloodied, battered body of her own mum, he'd sexually posed his mother's body. There was absolutely no thought for his sister. He purely wanted to gratify himself. Simple as that. So I don't buy into it for 1 minute that he's trying to reduce the trauma level on his sister seeing this scene. Oh, his sister even finding out about this scene. You don't actually have to see this to feel trauma, just imagining it. If you're related to Kimberly, you're going to live it just through the explanations that you're going to see in the press. Now, Davis explained that after he'd gone through with the killing, after he'd raped his mother, he was covered in her blood. He said it was all over his face, it was all over his glasses, so he wanted to take a shower. And then he says to the detectives he also wanted to wash his penis. Now, one would imagine that's because of forensic evidence, although it's useless because we know that he ejaculated inside his mother. But it could also be about the shred, the tiny shred, and it must be very, very small. Imagine a tiny, tiny speck of light in just a universe of darkness. But it could be there was just that tiny bit of shame in that moment, which is why he wants to wash his penis, because he wants to remove the reality of what he's just done to his mother. I may be wrong. It might just be that he wanted to wash himself because he wanted to clean himself up. Then he gets dressed into fresh clothes and he puts a few belongings in a backpack, gets on his bike, and he leaves around 10 p.m. that evening. And he just goes and zigzags through the streets for a while, doesn't really have a plan. And then at some point he discards his bike, he discards his backpack in the bushes, it's close to a railway track. And it's at this point he thinks to himself, well, life's changed. Gonna have to face it. Police are gonna be after me. I'm a kid. How am I gonna support myself? How am I gonna escape? He's not exactly streetwise and savvy. So he realizes that his life's taken this massive turn and it's best if he hands himself in. And one, I think he wants to. I think he's some pathetic individual who has very little meaning in the world, aside from meaning to the person he has destroyed. And therefore, because he is somebody of so little meaning, to create notoriety, to create a position where people talk about him, know about his crime, are horrified by his actions, that in itself could be relatively alluring. And also, he's going to get fed. He's going to get housed. At the end of the day, he won't have to worry about paying bills. So there'll be that kind of real narcissistic reality to this, which is what's going to be easier for me, going on the run or handing myself in? And also, who takes control in that moment? Me, or do I let law enforcement? So again, the narcissism plays out, the controlling of his story.
Where was this at? Where did you end up at?
Ultimately, I ended up in the backwoods of a ditch.
Here in town or out of town?
Robstown.
In Robstown. How did you get over there?
In Corpus Christi, I biked halfway, and then I got to the train tracks, and then I ditched the bike in the thick woods, and then from the train tracks, I just walked.
To Robstown?
Yeah.
Okay, and then you came up to the, was it like the first house that you saw, or how did you,
how did you
go to this house for, to ask to use the phone?
Initially, my plan was just to run as far as I can, but then I ended up crying my eyes out in like the thick woods, like, what did I do? And I realized, you don't know what you lost till you've already lost it. And so I knew that my life wasn't going to go anywhere, not anymore. So I just kind of gave it up midway.
Mm-hmm.
So during this interview, when he's turned himself in, when he's been caught, he gets asked if he regrets what he'd done to his mother. And he says he did in a way. I mean, like I said, this guy is so warped because on one level we can say, well, there is nothing loving about his actions, and I completely concur with that. But it is possible for people to love people even when it's a bad kind of love. So I imagine again, like I said, in that tiny pinprick of light in the universe of darkness, that actually there are some loving feelings that Davis has towards Kimberly, but unfortunately they're outweighed by his massive evil. Not really any other way of saying it. Massive amount of demonic style evil. One day, I imagine he'll meet his master and it probably won't end well. There'll be a lot of burning. But anyway, this is what he says. He loved her in a way. Now, the detectives are still looking for a motive because they're like, how can this kid, this young man, this 18-year-old, go from literally seeming to live a life where no one is necessarily noticing anything that stands out too much, and now he's just done the most heinous kind of crime ever? Is there something that Kimberly has done in the past that could not mean she deserves this kind of end, but would at least help us to gain insight into why he reacted with such brutality? Now, when they ask him that question, without hesitation, Davis says, absolutely not. She was the best mother. And then he tells detectives, I'm just a terrible, disgusting person.
You feel sorry you did this to your mom?
In a way, yes, but I wouldn't take back what I did. It's strange, really. I did love her. In a way.
Has she been mean to me?
No. She's been the best mother.
Okay, so she is nothing that she did?
Oh, absolutely nothing. No.
If I was to ask you, what did she do to deserve this, what would you answer?
Absolutely nothing. I'm a cruel, disgusting person. Yeah, basically.
I mean, at least he does get that bit right. He really is a terrible, disgusting person. But again, it's heartbreaking, isn't it? Because you're sitting there and thinking, wow, Kimberly really is a fabulous mother. She really is a compassionate human. She's been a doting parent. And none of that protected her from this predator. None of the very things in relationships that we often believe make us secure and safe counted. She was the best mum ever. And look at how her life has been ended by the very son that she cherished. Now, following that interview, Davis then, obviously, because he's been so agreeable anyway, goes on to actually help the police find out where his bike is and where his bag is that he abandoned earlier. On one hand, you could say, God, this is unusual, because when we see a lot of murder suspects, they kind of do absolutely everything to distance themselves from the crime. They want to avoid guilt. They don't want people to be able to make them bang to rights by bringing in any kind of incriminating evidence. But this isn't what he's doing. You know, Davis immediately accepted responsibility. He's cooperative throughout. And I'll tell you why. It's because he's proud of what he'd done. He absolutely enjoyed describing his actions to the detectives, and the reason for that is he'll be reliving it, could be even sexually enjoying the experience of sharing that information. We know that about these kind of killers. The origin of the moment that they actually carried out the murder is something they want to anchor themselves to again and again and again. It helps them. That's why people take mementos, because it means that they can connect with it. It's the most macabre and dark type of anchoring there could ever be. And the enjoyment that he gets from reliving them, the enjoyment he gets from knowing the impact that his words would have on the audience, all of that helps him relish the information that he's sharing. And bear in mind, he's also telling them his darkest fantasies, which again, I'm just going to throw it in there. I think that's a misstep of the interrogators. It's not necessary for this particular crime to be actually solved, and it allows him to further enjoy the fantasy that he's held in his head. You know, having that audience and describing cutting the head off a woman, dressing her in a dress, then having sex with her corpse, etc. It's allowing him to perpetuate those grotesque fantasies that he has. I think one of the most shocking things about his police interview is how calm he is. There's no disbelief, there's no self-revulsion or repulsion at what he's done. He's just very able to go ahead and very matter-of-factly just tell people exactly how things played out, as if he was just describing what he bought at the shops. Absolutely no recognition whatsoever of the enormity of his actions. I would say that when I listen to him, I am reminded of Ed Kemper and the interviews that he's done. They both really enjoy talking about their sadistic paraphilias. And at times, during Davis's interview, he even has a smirk on his face. Also, when you think about the fact that both Ed Kemper and Davis, they killed their mothers, they had sex with their corpses, I would say there is a distinction in the way that they use language. So Kemper, who's a very, very bright man, we have to remember that he was almost gifted on an IQ level. So he's got more flowery language that separates him. So he uses a lot of euphemisms, which are all intended to tone down his actions. So I humiliated her body and had sex with it. That's the kind of language that Ed Kemper uses, whereas Davis doesn't hold back. But we are also at a very different juncture in time. So we've got used to more violent expressions because of our media, for example. So that could be why Davis is more comfortable using that kind of language, that more direct language. But they're very similar. And Davis said that he was sane, that he absolutely knew what he was doing, that he knew that what he was doing was wrong. And he even said that it was obvious that he needed to be actually punished for the crime. And he suggested that he probably need to go to prison for 100 years.
At this point, what do you consider yourself? You consider yourself, I'm going to use a dirty word, okay? But I don't mean to insult you, okay? Do you consider you mentally disturbed? Do you consider yourself crazy? What do you consider yourself, any of those? Or do you think you're okay? You just got some bad thoughts?
I'm not mentally disturbed. I mean, I'm sane. I know exactly what I did. I know that it's wrong in the traditional sense of wrong.
Well, it was just a fantasy you had, and you had to carry it out.
Yeah.
Not yet.
Now I feel vaguely, kind of like I'm done. Mm-hmm.
I think that we should allow Davis to be his own judge and jury. I would be accepting of such a sentence. I believe such a sentence is appropriate. I believe it will save a lot of money if we just allow Davis to go ahead and evaluate what is required for his punishment. Just throwing it out there, would be cost effective to do that. Now, understandably, at 18, he's an adult, but they're also going to want to figure out what the hell was going on with this young man. So they start evaluating him, mental health experts take a look at him, and we really didn't need them to tell us that he was somebody who had antisocial personality disorder. His actions conclude that that would be the case. And the other thing that they say is, even though he has this affliction to some degree, I mean, antisocial personality disorder is pretty horrific, isn't it? Because arguably it could be something that you're born with as opposed to just developing in your experience in the world. But when you have it, it means that obviously you think very differently and distinctly from the average human. But they all say that he has this. And on top of this, he's also sane. So as far as they're concerned, that personality disorder does not mean in any way, shape or form that he didn't fully know what he was doing when he carried out the crime. When he murdered and raped his mother, he was completely compos mentis. It's as simple as that. Now, despite, this is the bit where I'm like, oh, why do they do this? Why do they do this? I ask all of you, I ask the gods of common sense, why do criminals do this? Bear in mind, we have a videotaped confession to the police. We have notes that he's written. We have a step-by-step guide as to how he's carried out the crime. We have the couple who he went and knocked on the house and was like, I've murdered somebody, can I borrow your phone? You can't have somebody more bound to rights. It's as simple as that, literally. But he decides to plead not guilty to the charges of first degree murder and rape. I would have loved to have been the defense solicitor, the defense attorney when he's actually saying not guilty, you know? Obviously you've got it all on video that you've confessed. You said you're totally aware of what's happened and you know why you killed your mother and she didn't deserve it. And, you know, you've literally given us a step-by-step guide to how you carried out the crime and kind of enjoyed telling the detectives all about your fantasies. And you left those notes and you've admitted all of it. So obviously when we go to court, you're going to say you're guilty, right? I'm not guilty. Sorry, do you want me to just repeat all of those very succinct, clear, direct, and absolutely truthful points again? No, I'm just going to go not guilty. Wow. because I'm a massive narcissist and I believe I control the world, so hey, why not throw it out there? At this point, I would be like, I am really poorly. I'm gonna remove myself from the case and go and spend some time in a cabin in the woods for maybe a few years, because people like you, you really scare me. But it doesn't surprise me as to why he says not guilty at that point, because just think about it. This is a young man who knows that he's going to prison, probably for the rest of his life. And he's not gonna have a lot of time to be able to hold court and to also relive his fantasies. And what happens when you go not guilty is, of course, you have to have witnesses, you have to hear all the statements, you get to see the actual crime photos. And also, the killer is on full view in that moment. And I think he would have found that really alluring. It's another control technique, and it's another way of making sure that he gets to relive the fantasy again and again and again, and control people's pain again and again and again, and traumatize people again and again and again. So it makes absolutely perfect sense that this guy goes not guilty to charges of first degree murder and rape. But before his trial begins, probably because his defense attorney was like, I'm not doing it. You're literally gonna get a sentence that's 3,000 years. That kind of thing was going on. He actually goes ahead and he changes his actual plea to guilty. This is in October 2014. Now, during the sentencing, the defense did try to argue for a lesser punishment. They said that they felt that he was suffering from a mental illness and that his actions demonstrated that he must have been. Now, the prosecution, of course, they have got a videotaped confession of somebody who's totally compos mentis and is very aware of why they've carried things out and has explained the motivation. And they say that means there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever to support that there is a mental illness. And again, there is something really frustrating when a defense uses mental illness in this, well, that's why he'd have murdered her. Absolutely not. He coolly, calmly, and without a shadow of a doubt, without conscience, murdered, mutilated, and totally disrespected his mother's body. So he's completely compos mentis and knows exactly what he was doing. Even the actions of Davis in court show you a level of detachment from the reality of his actions and, of course, the viewpoints of those who will know of them. So remember that couple that were in the actual scenario where he knocked on the door and they were the ones who helped him make the call to the police. They obviously have to come into court to identify Davis as the person who was present. And when they have to point him out, he actually waves back at them. So again, it's like a hi, seeing you again, thanks for using your phone. But you know what I mean? It's not making sense. It doesn't compute, because the mindset of somebody with this particular belief system of entitlement, they don't feel that they've really done anything wrong. So when he sees the couple, it's more of a social exchange. Oh, I recognize you. Hey, how's it going? When they're actually going, yeah, he's the murderer. It's so completely a juxtaposition to what's really playing out. And yet that demonstrates very accurately the kind of human predator that Davis is, and the way that he misreads emotional cues, the way he misreads the reality of what people are enduring in court in that moment in time. And it also shows, of course, the fact that he wasn't trying to deny anything that he did that night. You know, he's not pretending he doesn't know who those people are. He's literally waving at them as if you were seeing somebody that's familiar in the street. Now, when he gets sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 30 years. And it took the jury less than an hour to decide. I imagine that they didn't need the hour either. I like to imagine it was a long walk to where they had to deliberate, and they literally arrived at the room and then turned around and went back. Or maybe the person who was the court clerk was like, guys, I know you've all decided and we're actually just outside the court and you just want to go back in and say he's fully guilty, but we have to make it look like you really did have to consider these things though. Okay, so how long will that be? Well, what if I order a Starbucks, maybe some nice slices of lemon cake, and after you've ate those, we'll just pop back in. Brilliant. Can I get a soy hot chocolate, please? Anyway, you know that they would have decided. There's nothing to discuss, is there? And bear in mind, a minimum term of 30 years certainly doesn't mean that he's going to be out in 30 years. Now, apparently, when the sentence is announced, he literally smiles at the jury. It's just truly terrifying, isn't it? It really does chill you to the bone. Now, I've said all the way through this, Davis was a serial killer in the making. He really was. At the end of the day, he openly admitted that he fantasized for years and years and years about killing. And clearly, the moment he got an opportunity where he felt he had an entitlement to do that, he went ahead and did this. But also, he openly admitted that if he'd had the chance, he would have killed again. Because he didn't feel any aversion. He enjoyed it.
Sure.
You still feel like, you're done with your mom. You still feel like you want to keep on killing? To keep on, with other fantasies? Or how do you feel?
I came here to pay for my crime, so I guess I should continue with the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Truthfully.
Yes, definitely.
I would kill again.
Mm-hmm.
He's a narcissist. Absolutely no sense of remorse. Doesn't see people as humans. Doesn't see people as individuals living their lives with purpose and meaning. Just sees them, as he said, pieces of meat for his pleasure. It's interesting for me to have watched how the police interrogated him and by what they were told by him. But wow, they were excellent at remaining professional. You know, they remained polite, they were respectful throughout. And you know why? They knew that they were dealing with a narcissist. So they appealed to those narcissistic tendencies. In fact, on more than one occasion, they actually express admiration for him. They say that, they really appreciate how honest he is with them, how he's taken responsibility for his actions like a man. And at one point, one of the detectives even shakes his hand. This is about ego. This is about stroking that narcissistic, psychopathic ego. It's about playing, as far as he's concerned, into his hands. Ooh, they respect me. They like me. They're noticing my notoriety. They're appreciative of me, of my intelligence and my capacity to describe what's happening. But actually, the police are just manipulating him. They know exactly how to stroke that ego and get the information they require to send him down, I don't know, for a million years in reality.
But like I said, I admire you for the honesty. You were honest with us, and you didn't try to push us. Okay, and you're like a man. You came out here and took it like a man.
Now, looking at Davis's crime, what was he? Was he a disorganized offender? It's as simple as that. So whilst he might have fantasized for years about killing people, when you think about the act itself, it was kind of on the spur of the moment. It wasn't well planned. It certainly wasn't well executed. It was blitz, absolutely blitz killing, which is what we see with disorganized offenders. So he left loads of forensic evidence. Bear in mind, he killed and left his mother at the point of where she was murdered. That in itself, again, fits in with disorganized killer traits and the fact that he literally didn't necessarily know how to commit the crime. He'd actually thought it out in fantasy, but not actually considered how difficult it would be. That's evident as well. So, his plan demo was he was going to strangle his mother to death. That's what he'd done with the family cat before. But he'd messed that up. So then he told the police he'd actually had to change his MO to killing her with a knife. And that in itself, again, so it shows you that the switching up of that killing is because he didn't plan it accurately and he didn't really understand the kind of force that would be required to carry out that kind of killing. That's disorganized as well. Davis, if you were to look up in the dictionary, what is a psychopath? It would have a picture of him next to it. He's literally the very definition of a cold-blooded killer psychopath. The very worst type of human to walk the earth. Also, we know he displayed at least one of the McDonald triad whilst he was growing up, so he tortured animals. Also, we know he's very turned on by things like bestiality fantasies, murder fantasies, necrophilia fantasies, and actually actions. And again, we see that very similar to other violent psychopaths. So we can see that his personality and action traits are in line with these other psychopathic murderers. Another thing that I could say about him that is kind of in keeping with disorganized serial killers is, unlike the organized killers who tend to be quite high intelligence wise, Davis is more average to low, so he wasn't keeping up with things in school, often because his fantasies and belief systems lived outside of the realms of his interest than his education could provide. But he's certainly not totally disorganized, because he's clearly bright enough to express himself. He's a good communicator. But at the same time, like I've said, there are more disorganized elements to the crime. What I would say where he falls outside of that fully is the fact that this guy's sane. Whereas with disorganized killers, what you'll often note is that they're in a state of mental distress, sometimes even breaks of reality. Caveat, people have psychosis. Don't make them killers, but sometimes killers can also have psychosis. Again, we're not using the mental illness issue to ever excuse these kind of crimes. But certainly, as I said, Davis thinks he's incredibly organized, thinks he's incredibly well-versed in how to kill, but what we've seen from the way that he actually gets on with the crime is he falls short on pretty much all levels in that respect.
How do you do in schoolwork, thanks? Going back to school, how do you do in schoolwork?
Pretty mediocre. I never really could muster to even really care. I mean, I guess I excelled in English for all that was worth.
Okay.
Davis is now 27. And he remains incarcerated at the Jester Fourth facility in Richmond, Texas. That's actually a psychiatric facility of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. And I've looked up what that facility is, and it houses around 500 of the most mentally ill and the most violent prisoners in Texas. He will actually be eligible initially for parole in 2044, be 48 at that point. But genuinely, do I think he's ever going to get released? I'd be really surprised if he did. And actually, I think if a parole board were ever to accept that he were to be released, they would be tossing a coin as far as future danger versus rehabilitation is concerned, because I don't know about you guys, but as far as I'm concerned, this is a serial killer every day of the week. He loved the kill. He fantasized about the kill. He played out his violent fantasies and took time with the kill. And he killed the very person who loved him more than anybody in the world, his own mother. If he can do that, how could we ever trust that he wouldn't do that again to people that he cares less for? At the end of the day, it's my absolute firm belief, and actually my firm experience, that some mindsets can't be rehabilitated. And some predators, they're best caged for the rest of their lives. Until, of course, the devil takes them down to the fiery pits of hell, where he cages them for eternity on a very, very high heat. Just throwing it out there. It's how I cope. It's been one of those cases where, as a mother, it is absolutely horrifying to imagine that you could literally be living with your murderer, feeding them, clothing them, loving them, protecting them, reassuring them, comforting them, only to be culled in such a diabolical way. Let me know your thoughts, because this case, it's a shocker, isn't it? It's striking and astonishing and truly terrible. Poor Kimberly, poor Desiree, poor people who knew this absolutely lovely woman. The world has lost an angel. It's as simple as that. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.